Collar from NBC News Radio, broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful Southern California, and in parallel with Turfs Up Radio Studio in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So that's turfsradio.com. If you want to go listen to us on there, you can. And thanks for tuning into the Water Zone this afternoon, and hope everybody's having a good day. And I'm here with the most special co-host you could ever have in the world.
Chris Davey. I thought you were, that was an introduction where you leave the name out.
I was ready for you to speak up. You were so quiet during that whole introduction.
Yeah, so just, contemplating on the fires that we're dealing with here in Southern California.
There was
and
one on
Central
the 18
California,
coming back off right? the 15. They had it closed on Waterman when I was coming back from Vegas a little while ago. It was unbelievably smoky.
Wow. You anticipated what I was going to ask you. We didn't even talk about it.
Oh.
So did you see any on the way back on your drive today?
Yes, I did. I saw two fires, actually.
Yeah.
But that was the biggest one. They had the north side of the freeway closed for a little bit.
Yeah.
So.
And now the big fire up in Sacramento area now has expanded to some 10,000 plus acres now.
It's terrible.
Just awesome. And just outside the doors where we're sitting, the winds are blowing.
Oh, remember the last time we were here? You could smell the smoke in the room down here in the fires down here. It was terrible. Absolutely terrible.
Well, let's see if our other very special guest talk, speaking of those, Chris Austin is on the phone. Maybe she can add a little bit about the fires from her perspective. And Chris, just before I let you start, we're not going to limit you to 6 minutes and 38 seconds this week. we have some additional time.
No, we're going to give you the full Mountie here tonight.
The engineer came on and told me how long, and I was like, what, that I had to like 6:28. I was like, what is that saying? Make sure you shut up by then.
No. And sometimes, you've been in the recording stuff and everything else. Sometimes you get guests, and when we pre-record them, they go on and on and on and on. And we usually usually try to tell them, when you start hearing the music, that means, finish up what you're saying so we can go to a commercial or close the show or whatever. But it's not that easy because not everybody follows the rules. That's the way it works. But we're glad we have you on.
We get those people at conferences, too, where they you ask for questions from the audience, and then they get up and they kind of – it's not really a question. It's more like, here's what I think about this. And they go on and on, and you're like – okay, is there a question in there? Because, we were asking for questions.
Well, that's tough.
But you did ask about the fires. Yeah, they were on the outside of our town, outside of Santa Clarita, but not really close to where we are. At least one that, we had two fires. We had one on that end of town, the eastern, sort of east side of town, and then another one on the west side of town, not us, some people lost some homes today. It's really kind of sad.
Yeah.
In Southern California, Chris?
Huh?
In Southern California or in the Sacramento fire?
Yeah, Santa Clarita, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, first we got to tell everybody you're the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, and we want everybody to go to that website to get all the latest in water news in California, because we are very happy that we have you on our show, and we do support you as our audience knows, and we'd like to have everybody else kind of contribute also to do that. It's the best place to get news, and we want to certainly promote you. And Chris, I was hoping you'd jump in earlier. That's why I stopped, and I was waiting to say the host. And you just sat there quiet, but I'm glad you chipped in.
At least I didn't have my microphone off this time, which I've
done
like the last two times, right? I've started the first 30 seconds, and people waving at me. Frank the engineer flailing arms in through the window. Your mic's off.
There's the thing I heard the other day, actually, because I was up at the International Code Council symposium and conference yesterday and the day before. But I heard that a lot of fish are dying, or those up in the Delta. Is that true? Are they going away? Are they petering out?
Nothing dramatic has happened. It's the same decline that we've been experiencing, with some success in some areas, But, yeah, it's not looking good for the Delta smelt, and, you know, things aren't looking good. But then there are bright spots, like they're trying to restore salmon on the San Joaquin River.
Yes.
And they actually have, you know, they've tried to take this dry channel, turn it back into a river, and now that they have done that, then they planted some salmon about 3 years ago, and that's sort of the time scale. The salmon, you know, grow up in the river, they go out to the ocean for a couple of years, and they come back. And they actually had a large number of these salmon actually come back to the San Joaquin River, the restored river. So that was actually, you know, that's, so there are bright spots.
Yep.
But overall, you know, the declines continue. And there's so many different factors that that can be involved with that. So you just can't point to one thing. But, you know, there have been some successes, too. But, you know, all in all, it's not looking good.
No.
The big news this week was that the Trump administration finally released the biological opinions, which are the rules that govern the operation of the water projects in the Delta. And there's been quite an uproar, and what these new rules do really depends on who you talk to. The environmentalists say it's very harmful. They're going to, you know, further cause problems for the salmon and the Delta smelt. And the farmers and the water interests are saying, well, this is not really anything major more than we're updating the plan with some new, with the latest science. And, you know, it's not that big of a deal. It's more of an update. And, you know, but the general consensus is it is going to end up with more water being diverted from the Delta. And the interesting thing is we still haven't seen the state's version of these types of permits for these two projects in the Delta. So, and everyone's been speculating about the coordination between the federal and the state because, you know, there's been quite a big split between the feds and the state. So, and we still haven't seen the state's version, and it's going to be very interesting to see what happens if the state wants to be more protective of the fish and the federal, you know, government operations do not. They want to take more water. So it's going to be really interesting to see how that works out. And I think you can be pretty sure that litigation will ensue.
Oh, of course. It always does.
It's California water.
That's
it's California water, yeah.
Right?
Exactly, right? So it should be, you know, there's more focus on at the state level, ramifications that other people in other states don't see that are specific to California, right? So, I mean, laws like that, you know, really eat at the protection of endangered salmon. I mean, there's other stuff, you know, like it affects drinking water and groundwater recharge and river health and all that kind of stuff, right? That stuff should be closest in place and closest in time right here in the state, not federally mandated.
Right. Well, there's so many, you know, going to this conference the other couple of days, I mean, there's lawsuits about the Colorado River with Texas and Denver and all other places. It's just like there's so many water fights right now going on in this country. It's kind of hard. And they actually got a lot of cleanup and things to do. Instead of fighting all and spending all the money on courts, they need to get rid of the algae blooms, clean up the Delta. I mean, when does it, you know, when is that all going to happen?
Yeah, that's really the tough part because, you know, really if you're going to get anything done, you need to get people sitting down at the table working out solutions
yep.
together that everyone buys into, and that doesn't happen in a court.
No.
You know, but what can you say? You know, here we go. And we're really, and right now there's a real big rift between the federal government and the state government, especially California, you know, with President Trump, that whole administration has, you know, filed complaints, lawsuits against California in regards to water quality. And you know, it's been it's an interesting ride. Yeah, there was an article in the New York Times that pointed out that those violations that were filed against California, that, you know, the Trump administration just filed them. I mean, they went over the regional people, the regional staff at, you know, that EPA region. The mandate came from Washington, D.C., and the people in the regional office didn't even know about it, probably found out about it the same time, you know, it got sent out to San Francisco.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, which isn't really the way protocol is followed in the past. So, you know, what can you say?
No.
There's not a lot of protocol going on necessarily in this federal administration. So, but, you know, we'll see how it all turns out. You know, I just spent a 2 days up in Oakland at a conference called the State of the Estuary, which is about the San Francisco Bay and the Delta as well, because they're both connected. And it was actually a really interesting conference, and they really brought in a concept of equity. You know, in terms of water rates and environmental impacts, and also the issue of homelessness, although they sort of started rephrasing this as your unhoused neighbors, because they pointed out that, you know, when you have a homeless population in your town, it's generally not because people have bussed them in and dropped them there, but these are people who used to live in your city and were forced out for high rents or whatever. And they really talked about, you know, what to do about the homeless population in a wider sense, and also in terms of water quality, because these people are living, you know, out in the environment.
Right.
And, you know, I was really impressed by what they have already been doing. And in the city of Oakland, their homeless population has, like, doubled in the last 2 years. They've had an explosion of, you know, homeless people.
Wow. It's...
And so they've actually put out, you know, porta-potties, and they are providing trash service to these homeless encampments and all sorts of things. So, you know, the Bay Area has really been very proactive on attacking, you know, doing what they can for this population that's living out on the streets.
Well,
it's amazing.
Well, I think that's a good thing, but they're not resolving the initial problem, the initial root cause of all of that.
Well, they also talked about programs that they have in order to help keep people in housing, you know, when they're vulnerable. And there are actually programs that cities have put in place, and I believe Oakland has one as well, that if you're of a low income and you get a bill or something that threatens to, you know, knock you out of your housing, you can get applied to the city and get such a thing paid, so you can stay in your house and not get, you know, evicted.
Yeah.
So, you know, they've also been working on, you know, the other problem of, you know, trying to keep people from becoming homeless, as well as trying to get them back into housing. And they have programs for that, too. You know, they call them community cabins, I think, in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing what they've had to do, especially in the Bay Area, because they had an explosion of homelessness.
Oh, yeah.
And people just couldn't turn their backs on it. I mean, you get to the point you have to do something. And
no,
so
I agree.
They actually have been.
I agree.
You know?
Well, let me ask you another question that's kind of off of what we're talking about, but it was what I was going through the last couple of days with the ICC. on, especially up in the Bay Area, a lady named Paula Kehoe. I don't know if you know her.
Oh, yes.
She was on her show a couple of weeks ago, and she was also at this event that I was at. And she was talking about that there's new regulations in San Francisco that they're trying to do, or they are doing, that if you have a large new commercial building that you're going to construct, they want you to be able to put a water recycling plant in as part of your building.
Right. You need to, I know about this, you need to capture the water that falls on your roof.
Yep.
And also other types of water within the building, and use that on site. You know, you can take the water that falls on your roof and you can use that for landscape irrigation. And actually, the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, in their new building that they built, I don't know, 5-7 years ago, they actually have a wastewater treatment system
right
that
there.
Treats
yeah.
their, you know, their sewage,
right.
essentially, on the spot. And they have this thing sort of out on the sidewalk part of it, and it's really quite progressive.
Yeah, they should.
The other interesting thing about San Francisco that they have is that they have a lot of underground water that just flows in the. It's a part of the geology mm-hmm. Of the area, and they, in their basements, they have to pump this groundwater out, and because it's mineralized, it's not great groundwater, and they've been dumping that into their sewer systems, and so. Another thing they've been working on is figuring out how to reuse that water instead of just, you know, flushing it out of the foundation, but to actually use that as well. So, you know, San Francisco has been very progressive on, you know, reusing water on site.
Right,
and
right.
It's actually quite incredible.
Yeah, I thought the story Ms. Kehoe was doing was excellent. The one question that I did ask is, you know, by reusing the water, repurifying it to a certain degree where you can use it for flushing toilets and things of that, what happens with the lack of the water that would normally go to the sewer system, which pushes all that stuff out? Because if you don't get enough water in there, you're going to get stuff building up inside of the sewer lines, right? Don't they have to have a certain amount of water to keep the pressure so it moves the stuff that's inside of it out of the tunnels?
Yeah, I mean that is true. I mean, one of the problems of low flush toilets has been, you know, the lack of water versus, you know, other material that's in the sewage lines. And I don't know, you're asking me. Ms. Kehoe should have been able to answer that much better than me.
Well, no, I know, but I mean, you're the hear all, see all, know all. I mean, so I just thought maybe you ran into that. And I, as you pointed out, I mean, they showed pictures of their facility and some of the new projects that they're doing in a new stadium that they're building up in the Bay Area. Unbelievable stuff. I mean, it's really, really, they're clever about how they went to do this.
Absolutely, you know, and hats off to them.
Yep,
you know.
Absolutely. So I applaud them for what they've done. You're right; they're very progressive in that sense, and I think that's good. I think all the country needs to rethink what we're going to do with groundwater and reuse water. And we have a gentleman coming on the show afterwards who has a gray water system that I think adds on. We're going to learn more adds on to your existing home and so forth. But, yeah, I see that as probably one of the better ways we got to manage water, because with population growing not only in the world but in the United States, we're going to run out of that. You know, the two most precious things we've got is oxygen and water. Without that,
absolutely. And yeah. You know, there are a number of things that we're going to start facing constraints on as we move forward, and water is only just one of them.
Yeah.
My prediction is power is the next. So I think we're going to find electricity is, you know, not going to be as easily obtained, but we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I think also, you know, with all, you know, with all the buildings that they're going to be building and everything else, and they go to these, recycling and cleaning the water to reuse it for as gray water, I think that's going to help because, most everybody knows that pumping water in California is expensive. It uses, I forget the percentage, I'm sure one of you know the percentage of how much electricity is used in the state.
Substantial. At least 20%, yeah. I believe.
So doing these things on site would probably help out, save some of the pumping energy and stuff like that. I mean, there's lots of good, clever things, and I just hope it moves faster, the process of coming up with these ideas and implementing them. And I know there's lots of regulations. That's the part that gets me. I know we have to have them, but they take so long to get stuff done. That's the killer.
But also, we should give a shout out to the people there in San Bernardino because they have finished some projects this year and they have banked a lot of water. They were able to take advantage of some of this wet year that we had, and they had the infrastructure and they have been working hard to get groundwater levels up, and that's, the San Bernardino Valley Municipal District and the Water Conservation District and everything. I actually did an opening up there at a project they did off the Seven Oaks Dam, and that was in place this year for the wet season, so. There are agencies that have been looking ahead and have things in place. And, the listeners in the area of the radio station here, are fortunate to have, to be beneficiaries of that.
Right.
I remember the news coverage of that Seven Oaks Dam when it opened up. All the major news stations were there that day. Didn't see you on camera, though, Chris.
No, they didn't show me, but I did a little speaking part at the end. It was kind of fun. And then they took us on a tour, but it was raining that day. It was really a lousy weather day, but a great project. I mean, the interesting thing about that project is that they actually were able to create essentially a new water supply because they are now catching water that hasn't been caught before. And it was new water rights and actually an addition to the spreadsheet. But it took them a decade or more to get to that point.
Wow.
They did.
Yeah. That's good. It's always time, though, is the big advantage.
Yeah. Hey, so Chris, I know we're getting we're getting to the end of the 28 minutes I promised you. And maybe in November, I'd really like to take a time and talk about all of the funding opportunities that are available, right? Especially
a lot of grant money available.
Yeah, $24.2 million I think became available, right? Just
how do we get two out of that?
Yeah, it's.
Can we split that three ways, Chris?
yeah. But I mean,
I don't know. Yeah, I've been trying to highlight these opportunities for funding, all sorts of them, that are available to implement groundwater management and other projects as well. So.
Sure.
I think there's opportunities. I think I was talking to Chris here, but Chris, I think you know us as well. There may be opportunities for public education and public outreach and things of that sort. I think that would be a great thing to go pursue.
There are a couple opportunities out there for classroom education and other things. Adults need to be educated as well.
Yep.
EPA has a request for proposals they just put out that I haven't posted yet, but that's coming up too.
Be interesting to look at.
All right, Chris. Well, I think we're probably
commercial time.
Ready to pay the bill.
Pay the bill.
I don't hear the music though.
No.
Where's the music?
No. Frank is on the ball in there. He's coming with
it. There you go. We're trying to give you more airtime. So.
All right, everybody, check out mavensnotebook.com. Find out all the latest news from California and around the Western United States, a very valuable place to go just to enhance your knowledge.
And by being a member of Maven's Notebook, it's tax deductible, so you can write that off your taxes, and it's a great thing to have. And maybe you can get Chris's personal number and call her up, and she'll give you all the information you need.
Right, all right. Stay tuned, everybody. We have a special guest, Joseph Gallegos, coming up after the break. Stay with us, everybody.
Thanks, Chris.
Good evening, guys.
Good evening. Have a good night.
KCAA Loma Linda, 1050 AM, K292 FQ Riverside, and K293 CF Moreno Valley.
Love you, love you not. They love you. Satisfying your customers, it's a full-time job. Want an easy way to make them happy? Try having your ornamentals delivered straight to the job site with Nursery Direct. Could save you and your clients a pretty penny. Think about it, instead of driving to the nearest nursery, picking up the order, and then driving to the job site, the crew's able to begin work right away. That cuts time and labor. Savings you can pass on to your customers, and you can get your plants delivered direct, even if you don't have a nursery branch in your area. Here's another quick tip. Keep a substitutions list on standby for every project, so your team knows what to do in case a plant isn't in stock. Because there's nothing customers appreciate more than a project that finishes on time and on budget. They love you. They really love you. Aww.
If you knew there was a pipe cement that works better than the one you're currently using, is better for you and the environment, and costs the same or less, would you buy it? Oh, no-brainer, right? Weldon, the trusted leader in solvent cements for over 60 years, is pleased to introduce a new line of solvent cements that does all that. Introducing the Eco Series line of solvent cements for PVC piping systems. Not only does it work great and set fast, it also has 30% lower solvent emissions and less smelly fumes, a better workplace environment when you're installing pipes. But don't just take our word for it. EcoSeries products are the only solvent cements that are Green Seal certified for environmental innovation for effective performance, improved working conditions, and for use with potable water. Now available in a medium-bodied fast-setting blue formula, 905 Eco, and a regular-bodied fast-setting clear formula, 900 Eco. Pick up a can today from your local distributor and see, smell, and feel the difference, just like Joe Sweat, president of Sunrise Irrigation, did. He said, after using Weldon's 905 Eco, we immediately noticed the application was smooth and there was noticeably less odor than other blue solvent cements on the market. The guys love it. To learn more about Eco solvent cements from Weldon, visit the website at www.weldon.com or call the technical service hotline at 877-477-8327. That's 877-477-8327.
All right, welcome back to the second half of the Water Zone, and we have a great guest coming up as well. The company he has is called Gray for Green, and we have Mr. Joseph Gallegos. Joseph, good evening.
Good evening. How you doing?
Great. Thanks for calling in. Hey, just for our listeners, because you know, I just read the name, but they won't know what that means. Can you tell us a little about what Gray for Green is, and then how you got into this?
Yeah, sure. So Gray for Green is a gray water equipment manufacturer, and we manufacture DIY equipment or components for gray water distribution, which means that you take water from your laundry and your shower and are able to distribute it into your landscape. We focus in a lot of on using it for growing lawns, anything from St. Augustine, Bermuda, or Popescue. And the goal is to just be able to conserve water as compared to flushing that gray water down the drain.
Now, is this something that is retrofitted into a facility, or is it, or do you got to put it in at the beginning when you're building this stuff?
No, 85% of all of our clients are retrofit.
Oh, okay.
So they, you know, they go underneath the house, they cut the pipes at the, where the shower's at, or direct the laundry out to the outside. The other percentage is all in brand new build. So what's interesting is more and more cities are starting to add gray water codes to their building. Let's say Los Angeles, you're mentioning about San Francisco. San Francisco, their code is really aimed towards 250,000 square feet and above. But in the city of Los Angeles, they require all buildings that are started to get permitting in 2017 are all gray water equipped, meaning that they've already been built out, ready to take gray water for the landscape area. Mm. Pretty interesting.
It is. Now, you make a variety of products to do a whole bunch of things. You have what's called an aquifer pipe. You have some couplers. You have some expanders. You have filters and such. Can you kind of go through the process of what happens if somebody comes in and, say, retrofits a home, so they take... They can take the water from the dishwasher, from the laundry, from maybe a toilet. How does that all then? Where does it go? Go somewhere in a pipe somewhere. What's the flow chart of all of that?
So currently, all your wastewater goes into your typical sewer system, and it goes out into central processing plant. What happens with on-site gray water system is that the shower water, the sink water, and also the laundry is diverted to a central, we call it a surge tank. And on our website, we give all instructions how to build a surge tank for yourself, or you can buy one from us. And the idea is that that surge tank takes on that massive flow of water. And from that flow of water, we capture the hair and the lint with a simple filter, which runs about $1.50 every 3 months, that type of filter.
Okay.
But all the soap and everything else stays with the water. And then from there, it flows down to our aquifer pipes, which are buried a foot in the ground. And it's a special design pipe, because what it's doing is creating a virtual water table at the one-foot level. That's 1 foot below the surface. And the water flows into this pipe, and it seeps into a middle channel, kind of holds it in a trough. And that trough gets completely saturated. And when it gets completely saturated, what happens then is that the surrounding soil starts to wick it up. And it wicks it as far as 4 feet on each side of the pipe and as high as the 1 foot depth. And so now you have this giant moisture plume that's from 1 foot and above the surface. And it's from that moisture plume that plants are feeding from, and still use the traditional soaps and detergent, so they don't harm the plants. Maybe about 30 years ago, they would have hurt the plants, but consumers have demanded more and more to have a nice type of, detergents and soaps on our bodies, and that's related back to what goes into the soil when you use the aquifer pipe. What's cool is that trough now is able to spread out the water nice and evenly across your whole landscape. And then you set these up in parallel to each other every 3 feet or 4 feet or 6 feet, depending on the type of landscape you're doing. 3 feet for lawns and 6 feet for drought tolerant. And then the plants just feed from that consistent moisture plume that we're creating underneath the landscape. What's cool is that it cuts down all the water evaporation. So you're not putting water on the surface. So you're actually cutting the amount of water that the landscape needs, because it's not evaporating off the surface anymore as well.
So is it fair to say, Joseph, that over the last 30 years, with the advent of what I would probably call eco-friendly detergents and soaps and other cleaning stuff, that's sort of allowed this to happen?
Yeah, I would say so, because at one time there was a lot of detergents out there that had borax in them and they had other types of elements that would harm the landscape and harm the grass and cause burnt leaves. But now you have a lot of the eco-friendly material.
So if I understand this correctly, so if I was putting this in my house, I would hook up my dishwasher, I would hook up my washing machine and the sinks but I would not do the toilets. Is that probably the best way?
You cannot do the dishwasher in California.
Okay.
My understanding, you can do it in Arizona, but all those elements, like you said, but not the dishwasher, not the toilet.
Okay.
You're right. Those still continue to go down to the sewer system. And that's an interesting thing. You had mentioned, that diverting more and more water, is it causing problems with the sewer system? It does. I've talked to sanitation districts in the past, and they kind of frown a little bit about the gray water systems, because they want that influence to push all the poop and everything else down to the central processing plant.
Right.
Where it's cleaned, and sometimes it's either, you know, it's a lot of energy to clean all that, that wastewater. We put, in California, a lot of times we push it out to the ocean. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we push it back into the neighborhood as on the purple pipes, which is a recycled water or repurposed water. That's where you see the purple signs.
Right.
That's water that has went to the sewer system and it's been cleaned and then has come back as a purple pipe.
Yeah, so we've had somebody on the show before kind of talking about gray water, and their comment was, you know, all of the non-biological fluids that go into the sewer system helps to lubricate the sewer system, if you will. So what I heard you say is there's probably a point in time we're looking at where gray water conservation is kind of going to deplete the minimum flow in municipal sewers enough so that one day it becomes an issue.
Yeah, so what the city of Los Angeles does and the county of Los Angeles, they have certain areas where it accumulates, and they go out with pumping systems, trucks, and then they pump it out. It's a push along. But what I foresee is that state codes or state zoning, city zoning, will say, okay, we're going to build an apartment complex in this one area, but that apartment complex, all the influence needs to go to the sewer system so it can flush out the system, because it's at a, let's say, a higher elevation, and it pushes it through. Because what we're seeing also in the same kind of big world image is that some apartment complexes are now starting to do the calculations, say, well, I'm next to a park, I generate X amount of gray water, that water has value to it. So being able to take that water and then be able to transfer it in a district transfer to a park or to a freeway or some other, you know, greenery, and be able to water that all with gray water. Subsurfacely, of course, never on the surface. So now it becomes an economic advantage for that apartment complex to,
sure,
to overgenerate and then sell it to your neighbor, which is cool. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Now you have different. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say San Francisco allows that. San Francisco allows what's called district transfer of from gray water from one property site to the next property site.
Hmm. So on your filters that you have, I was reading that it depends on what you're connected to going to it. So if you're doing laundry, you clean the filter every 12 months. If you're doing a shower, that's every 24 months. And are they easy to get to, the access and so forth? Or and then I think you have some that are that you don't need to clean, or am I misread that?
No, you're correct. So there's two types of systems, and there's two types of gray water systems too. There's what's called a simple system that doesn't typically need a permit, and then you have the complex. So let's start out with a simple, which is a simple filter, all gravity flow, water coming from your laundry. And when it comes from your laundry, you know, when you're washing clothes and you put them in the dryer and the dryer goes and you take out that lint ball,
right,
from your dryer. That lint is also in the wash water. Mm. So when you're using gray water, it's all flowing into the gray water system, and the filter captures all that lint. And so it starts to accumulate, and you have to remove that filter and then put another filter so that it captures more of that lint so it doesn't go into the pipe and clog them up.
Okay. So it's basically you have to keep checking it, or is there some sort of automated sensor or something that says, hey, the filter is getting full?
No, this one, you on the simple system, you check it, you open up the lid and you can see it, and you kind of start to time it that it's about every month, every 3 months, on the depends on how much you wash and how much material goes down there.
Right.
Now on the automatic systems, those actually backflush. What happens is that the water flows into them, and then after so many cycles, so many days, it'll bubble up, it'll send air into that system, and it'll push all that lint and everything else up into the water and then flush that out to the sewer. So that way it's constantly flushing out all the lint and the hair and everything out to the sewer after basically 20 cycles. So that those are more automatic and they kind of self maintain themselves, so you don't have to look at them.
Yeah,
but once a year,
back flushed in black water. Yeah.
They push it down to the black water. Then there's a third system, which is called the NSF3 system. That's the type of system you were talking about a little bit earlier for using gray water to flush your toilets and and be able to reuse it as, you know, on the surface and items like that. But those systems are a little more expensive, though.
Yeah, and, well, I'm assuming because you probably got it, aside from the regular filter, you probably have to use a ultrasonic light and ultraviolet light and do all kinds of things to get the water to a different state, I would assume.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. It uses UV lights, then it uses charcoal to polish up the water, clean it, make it look nice and like it's drinkable. And so it's taking it to another level.
Oh. Now, you also made...
Yeah, we try to focus on the DIY.
Okay. So you sell the components, but do you do installations as well?
No, we've done installations in the past to do show proof of concept and best practices. Now we actually have a number of different landscapers and contractors that take our product and do the install. A homeowner can actually load our website and look at the videos. We have a whole series of videos that how to do it yourself.
Right.
And if they don't want to do it themselves, what they do is if they get their plumber to look at the website and says, okay, this is the plumbing I want you to do, and they show the landscaper the same thing, and that way they can go ahead and educate themselves on how to put the gray water system in.
I did watch some of the videos. I got to ask a question. Are you the guy in the yellow shirt?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I am the guy in the yellow shirt.
Okay, just curious. So, the videos, I've watched a couple of them, and they were very intuitive, and it seems relatively simple. You also make these plastic root barrier material?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Right? No, go ahead. Ask a question.
No, I was going to say, can you explain what those are for our listeners?
Yeah, so we manufacture a root barrier. And what's interesting about the root barrier, it's actually a story behind that. We received a grant from SC Johnson, the guys who make the Ziploc bags, and they wanted us to figure out how to use more of that type of plastic, which is called post-consumer film, and into our products. And so we tried it in the pipe. It wasn't quite working with the pipe, but it did work with the root barriers. And so we make that root barrier, which you put along the sidewalk to keep the roots from going underneath the sidewalk. But we make that out of a post-consumer plastic film. That's the same film that you see around your toilet papers or your rolls of paper towels or even the Ziploc bag. The whole idea is to be able to reuse that type of plastic and take it out of the stream of the waste fill and instead recycle it and upcycle it into another product. What's cool about the root barriers, we're starting to do some tests on what's called a second skin. So we're using it to shade a building so that way the heat doesn't affect the building. But that's kind of like in the earlier areas. Another area that we're doing that with is with the gray water. We're working with some corporate clients to grow vines on the south side of their building. That way it shields the heat from hitting the building and it cuts the energy consumption.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah. What we find is that saving water is great, but the economics behind it, we're such a great society that we're able to transport water and process it at such a low cost. The water savings are very low because we're so good at cleaning it and processing it and treating it. Doesn't mean that we have a lot of water, just the way that we bring it from Colorado River or the Delta. It has a cliff, meaning that we can ship it and transport it. And the way that our agencies are designed, they can only add whatever it costs them to do that. They don't take profits or they don't manage supply and demand. So they process it and push it, but at some point we're going to run out of it. And then it's like, well, we ran out. But so it has a cliff. But getting back to the thing is that the idea of using gray water to grow more lush landscapes to cut the energy consumption that's where we're finding a better economic on ROI, to be able to show corporations, hey, if you shade this whole south side of this building using vegetation grown with gray water, there's an economic value to the energy consumption as well as the saving of the water.
So the energy component to that, there's have you done any studies to measure what the savings are? I mean, as well as just, you know, advancing the health of the landscape and, you know, not putting as much gray water into the oceans. I'm sure that there's an economic component to saving energy as well, right?
Yeah, there is. We have two studies that will be up on our website by the end of tomorrow, actually. One was for the city of Los Angeles, and they had us plant a number of trees in a neighborhood to shade the houses and cut the heat consumption in those houses, but using gray water to grow the trees. And so the long-term effect of that, because you spread it out over the life of the tree, is pretty substantial. And so they are looking at actually expanding that, and we're talking to other utilities, electric utilities, to expand it. So it's funny that the utilities departments are now looking at using gray water to create these lush urban forests to shade houses. The other study is what we call the climate mitigation report, and that takes more of a commercial building and uses the same concept and how much that water is able to cool the building by growing large trees, and the transpiration off of the trees create a nice breeze across the landscape and cools the building as well.
Hey, so let me ask you another question then. And maybe this is a little forward-looking, Joe, but you know, lots of the facets of the water industry are just looking at exciting futures, right? And just by talking to you, there's obviously a lot that you're looking forward to do. So can maybe you can help us and just give us a little forward-looking thoughts about where you see Gray for Green going. I know you're working with universities and other companies and brain and think tanks all around. Is there anything that you can reveal to us?
Yeah. There's some really, really interesting things that we're working on right now. We're working on what's called a net zero water building strategy for the company. That's where we're taking water from it that's from the condensation of the air conditioner unit and reusing that for toilet flush at first, but then we're eventually getting into what's called atmospheric water generation. That's the condensation still from the air conditioning, but using that and cleaning it so you can drink it. And then whatever is left over is gray water that then flows to the landscape. The landscape then cleans the gray water, grows this lush landscape again, and that gives off the transpiration from the plant, which then is collected from the condensation on the air conditioner. So you create this whole complete urban water cycle within the urban environment so that buildings become self-sufficient and generating their own water and processing their own water all within a tight ecosystem of a city. But think about that, is that if the water infrastructure ever collapses, earthquake, man-made, that these right. individual buildings can stand alone and generate their own water and be able to support the local area.
Right.
And the type of buildings are kind of like the Costcos and the Targets and the Walmart. Those are styles of buildings because they have a lot of air conditioners on the roof that are generating way more water than what is needed within the building itself.
Right, just from condensation.
Just from condensation. Right. We have a building in Santa Monica that generates 6,000 gallons a day and a five-story commercial building. It's just because it's so humid along our coast. And they talk about how climate change is going to continue to increase the humidity because of evaporation off the ocean. So that kind of creates that whole cycle that allows us to do that.
So does your system, I don't recall seeing it, but so when the water is collected, this gray water or secondary use water is collected, it goes to a tank, is that correct? A large tank, storage tank?
And then it goes to what's called a surge tank. The surge tank just allows it to collect the surge of water. It doesn't hold it per se. It just it's a pass-through system, so it's gonna take that rush of water and then allow it to percolate right away into the landscape. It doesn't.
Could
it's
you,
not meant to hold and pump out.
Well, could you put it in a holding? The reason I'm asking this question, we were having discussions with another entity, water agency, and I was thinking, gee, if they could use your type of system and then have it go to a collection tank, and then have it pumped out into an irrigation system, because I saw the thing where it comes off the roof, where you have it going into a 10-foot by a couple feet wide to feed the water, because it's real close to that. But suppose they had some turf and they really wanted to water that. I know you said you can space them out, your systems out, but suppose they wanted to put it on with a timer or anything like that and put it through an irrigation system. Can they do that as well? And do you need special permits for this?
Yeah, they would have to clean it to what's called NSF 350, which is a costly service per gallon that you generate.
Mm-hmm.
It's currently at some time in the future that price would come down, but to do it cost effectively, you'd have to do non-treated gray water, and you can put it on a timer, but you cannot use, by law, you cannot apply it on the surface. You have to apply it subsurface.
That makes sense.
That makes sense, yeah.
For pets or kids or...
Yeah, you don't want that be in contact with humans and...
We don't want to be puppy killers. Cute little puppies. We can't hurt them. So typically...
You asked what we're doing, you know, with future. So we talked about the net zero water building, but another project we're working on is in the Central Valley with almond growers and nut growers. And we call this the net zero water farming. And instead of using gray water, we're using well water or district water. And the concept here is that we take the same pipe, but a larger diameter, 6-inch diameter, and we place it 5 feet underneath the ground, in the service row of the orchards. And so at that distance, we eliminate the water loss to evaporation. So now we're doing only what's called irrigation for transpiration, only the water that the trees are taking up to grow, to be healthy and thrive and everything else.
Wow.
So we cut the water by 50%. So instead of using 6 acre feet on an orchard, you're only using 3 acre feet. And then in the wintertime, we use the same pipe to take the rain and the spring runoff and recharge the groundwater 3 acre feet. So now we're putting as much water back into the groundwater as we're taking out. Now that's really exciting.
Yeah.
For California, we probably have close to 2 million acres of nut crops, 1 million in almonds, and then we have walnuts and pistachios.
Wow.
You know.
So, hey, Joe, we're running up against the NBC News Hour here. So,
but real quickly, where can they get a hold of you?
They get a hold of us at grayfordgreen.com, and just phone numbers and contact information there.
And you're local in Southern California, correct?
Yeah, we're based out of Southern California, Long Beach, but we're up and down the coast. Like, I'll be in Sacramento next week, and then up there again in December for the almond show.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you coming on the show and telling us about your product. Like I said, I saw it and I was excited about learning more about it and for our listeners. And we may call you back and talk some more on this subject. So we appreciate taking time in. Thanks a lot, Joseph, and you have a great week. And real quickly, don't forget, we got the irrigation show coming up in December. So we'll tell you more about that next week. So everybody have a good week. And remember the most important thing you have to do, and it's a must on this show,
Think Blue. Good night, everybody.
Have a good week.